Thank all of you out there for being with us for another Political Rewind. I'm Bill Nigut. It's good to be back on the air for this special edition on this Thursday. Of course, we were off yesterday so that GPB Radio could bring you the impeachment hearing, the first of the public hearings on impeachment, which we'll talk about with our panel a little bit later in the show. So let's get right to the news of the day. Tamar Hallerman joins us from Washington. She, of course, is the AJC Washington correspondent. But Tamar, you're down to your final days in D.C. before coming back, being reassigned to Atlanta, right?
I know. It's wild. I've been here for 12 years, so very bittersweet.
I'll bet it is. But at least you've picked a quiet time to leave Washington.
Nothing happens here.
Your replacement, Tia Mitchell of the AJC, is getting up to speed up there, and we'll be talking to her and really are looking forward to the fact when we have you on, you'll be right in the studio with us. That's really good for all of us.
Exactly. Won't be a disembodied voice anymore.
That's right. Here in the studio with me today, Buddy Darden, former Democratic congressman from the 7th District. He represented Cobb County, basically the Chattahoochee River, all the way up to the Tennessee line. How are you, Buddy?
I'm great, and I love this new studio, Bill. This is outstanding, and it's a pleasure to be here.
Thank you. If you're watching on Facebook Live, you've seen the studio before. If you haven't seen it, then go to the GPB news page on Facebook, and you can see what we're all dealing with right here. Edward Lindsay is back with us, former Republican member of the Georgia House, represented Atlanta for like a decade, right?
That's right. That's right.
How are you, Mr. Lindsay?
I'm doing well, and I will echo what Buddy said. This is a really nice new set of digs y'all have here.
Well, we're very happy about it. Let's get right to work on the news of the day, and let's put off talking about impeachment for at least a little while. And let's start with, Tamar, the new AJC poll. We were so glad that your boss, Kevin Riley, finally ordered up a poll so we could start getting some ideas about how Georgians are feeling about a variety of issues. You worked with the University of Georgia School of Public and International Affairs. There's like more than 1,000 registered voters, 3% margin of error. So that's the setup for all of this. And Tamar, if we can, let's take it sort of in order of state officials, state elected officials, and then go to the stuff about the president's approval rating and impeachment. So if I can, just for the heck of it, let's start with Brian Kemp. Your poll shows that he has a 54% approval rating, which is up like 40 from 46 in April and 37 in January. I mean, it's really interesting how he shot up in favorability here in Georgia, Tamar.
Yeah, really been marching upward ever since he was elected. And it's quite a different story compared to what we've seen with David Perdue and Donald Trump, who've been more steady. But definitely good signs for Brian Kemp as we've been going through the year.
Well, you know, Edward, what's interesting about this in a way is when he supported and then signed HB 486, the bill that virtually outlaws abortion in Georgia, there were a great many people who thought that it would really hurt him in terms of his approval among voters across the state. And yet, I don't know that anybody was thinking specifically about that issue, but it certainly hasn't hurt him.
Well, the fact of the matter is when you're governor, you're dealing with a broad range of issues. And while, a voter may disagree with you on this issue or that issue, when it comes to those what I like to call sort of breakfast room table issues, he's been very strong on. And he's also enjoying a time in which, as shown by the poll in the AJC, voters have a very positive view of Georgia in general. I think, 60% tomorrow? And also have a very favorable view of the Georgia economy. And so when you have those things going for you and you're the governor and you're basically a low-key kind of a guy, and Brian Kemp is a technocrat low-key kind of a guy, you're going to enjoy some favorable ratings.
All right. So, Buddy, Edward says an interesting thing. A governor is going to be judged on a variety of issues. Fair enough. But we know that Governor Kemp is, if we look at a lot of the other findings in this poll, there are many issues on which Georgians seem to have a somewhat progressive views. And Governor Kemp is far from a progressive governor and yet continues to grow in favorability.
Well, people expect the Georgia governor to mind the store and to keep the state running, to keep the state out of debt, to protect us on our roads and highways, and to keep our infrastructure going. The governor of Georgia has an immense responsibility on a lot of things, as he pointed out. However, he's going to run into some problems pretty soon if he doesn't find a way to get around some of these more divisive issues.
Like what?
Like the abortion issue, for example. And I'm afraid, notwithstanding the fact that he's trying, doing the best he can, I don't think his health care plan is going to fly, because we've already foregone in this state more than $15 billion since ACA was enacted. And so I think he's in a learning mode, and I think he's making a really good effort. But at the same time, he is at least smart enough not to get out there and say outrageous things and pretend that he knows things he doesn't know. And so I would give him a pretty good mark at this point for making a good effort and trying to bring people together in the state. He's done a pretty good job of that as well with some of his appointments.
Well, one thing to keep in mind, let's just sort of talk about the health care issue, for instance, is that the poll by the AJC shows the danger of Democrats going too far on the health care issue by a pretty wide margin. For instance, Georgians do not support Medicare for All that's being supported by a lot of the national Democrats and all. And so he's taken what I would call sort of a down-the-middle-of-the-road position on the health care issue when it comes to expanding Medicaid, tying it to certain work requirements. And I think overall that's going to be something that most Georgians will approve.
So Tamara, let's go to that piece of the poll. In being asked about Medicare for All, only 40% of the respondents support the idea, 53% oppose it. Interestingly enough, independent voters are basically split on the issue. But here's the thing, with the Democrats heading to town for their presidential debate next week, nearly one-third of Democrats say it's a bad idea. What Edward says about that is interesting, isn't it?
And, Bill, I'm one of them. I'm one of that one-third that thinks it's a terrible idea.
Tamara?
Now, one of the things about Medicare for All is that there's no real definition. There's not a single definition for it. And the poll does not go into that. It does not say, here's what Medicare for All means. And you talk to different candidates and they say different things. And I think that gray area is really what a lot of these candidates are going to be having, you know, the kind of the ground they're going to be playing on next week. If you're Elizabeth Warren or Bernie Sanders, you're going to explain why, you know, it's so important. You know, we're not talking about a total takeover of our health care plan, or maybe you are. And that's also up for candidates who want to just expand Obamacare to also explain that as well. One interesting thing, you know, in previous polls, we did, the AJC and UGA did poll Georgians based on their support of expanding Medicaid, mm-hmm. Which is something Brian Kemp has not wanted to do. And you know, voters have shown, I believe it was 70% in our last poll.
70%, you're exactly right.
They supported it.
Overwhelmingly.
Exactly. And so a lot of it, you have to pay attention to the language that these pollsters are using. What exactly are they asking these respondents? And they really did not provide any details. So that's something to keep in mind.
All right,
but remember this when it comes to the Medicaid for All. It's been topic A in each and every one of the Democratic debates. And quite frankly, it's been tarred and feathered by a lot of the Democratic candidates against those in the field who are supporting it. So it's not as if the issue hasn't been discussed widely during this political season.
Well, that's right. And I think it's going to be interesting. I would guess that given that this is, what, the fifth debate coming up next week, given that there's four women who are moderating this debate, I'd be surprised if health care was this, once again, was the top question they posed. If for no other reason, Tamar, then I would think that MSNBC and the Washington Post would like to, you know, throw some things up in the air and get another lead for their stories.
Yeah.
Exactly. And one thing I'm curious to see if they talk about is maternal mortality.
Yeah.
Georgia's been pretty low in its ranking, or I guess pretty high. A lot of maternal mortality here, especially among communities of color. I'll be interested to see if folks talk about that.
All right. Let me go with another figure here that I found fascinating. So, Tamar, 50% of the people in this survey approve of David Perdue's job performance. Fine. In the past, he's always polled better than either President Trump or Governor Kemp on approval ratings. Now he's still at 50%. But what's odd about it is 35%, only 35%, say that they'll support him in next year's election. 41% say their choice depends on who the Democratic nominee is. So what do you see first, Tamar, and then I'll get Edward and Buddy in here. What's the disconnect there?
I think a lot of folks are just waiting to see who the Democrats are going to nominate. Right now, we have four Democrats who are kind of duking it out for the nomination, and that'll say a lot, right? You got very different flavors of candidates. You have very progressive folks like Ted Terry, and you have people who are kind of going more toward the center. I think you talk to David Perdue's folks, though, and they see a lot of optimism in that 41% of voters who are still kind of to be determined in their vote. They see it as a jump ball. You can grab a lot of those voters. And if 50% of folks already approve of your job performance, they see it as a position of strength.
Buddy?
In past years, Georgia senators, Democrat and Republican, have had a tradition of being independent and putting the state first and making up their mind based on the issues. And now we have a United States senator who has just become a toady for the president, and whatever he says is fine. And I think that David Perdue needs to return to being a United States senator from Georgia rather than a Trump acolyte. And if Trump prevails and becomes more popular in the state, that might be good for him. But I don't think I would hitch my wagon to his star as heavily.
I think the what you need to sort of focus on when it comes to this poll is the fact that he has a 14-point advantage over any Democrat. And you also need to start taking a hard look at the field. The one thing I would disagree with what Tamar said a moment ago is I'm not real sure which of the Democratic candidates right now is trying to tack toward the middle. Right now, all of the ones who are announced
you
candidates.
You wouldn't say that Pete Buttigieg is—
No. The Senate Republican.
Oh, the Senate. The
Democratic Senate candidates.
I apologize. You're,
here in
of
Georgia.
Course. Of course.
I really haven't seen much evidence of any of those four major candidates running for the U.S. Senate hoping to run against Perdue or attacking toward the middle. I think all of them are attacking as far as to the left as they can at the present moment.
Okay, that's so a concern to me, too, as a Democrat.
Yeah.
All right, a couple more figures before we move on to another subject. And let's go ahead and go to the president. Number one, the president has a job approval rating, if you combine strongly approve with somewhat approve, of 44%. He's underwater here in Georgia, just as he is across the country. And if you take somewhat disapprove and strongly disapprove, he's at 54%. So, Tamar, and then in fantasy matchups, and I think we all need to always caution that these kinds of fantasy matchups, they're an interesting snapshot, but they don't really say anything about what a head-to-head campaign among any of these people with the president would be down the road. Nevertheless, Joe Biden beats him 51-43 in Georgia. Bernie Sanders beats him 48-44. Elizabeth Warren, a little more narrow, but not much, 47-44. Buttigieg, 46-43. Kamala Harris, 45. Basically, these top-tier candidates, all beat him or are within the margin of error of beating him. That's interesting, Tamar.
Sure. I mean, we're also more than a year out, and so much can change between now and then. One thing I wanted to piggyback off what Buddy was saying and kind of how, Perdue is this Trump acolyte and how he should maybe distance himself from the president. I mean, one thing that's very notable, Trump has a 44% approval rating in this poll, but Perdue is sitting at 50%.
Yeah.
So clearly in the eyes of some voters, he has distinguished himself from from Donald Trump. And that's very notable because talking to him on Capitol Hill every day, most of his policy positions are about the same. But another note about Trump, he is underwater, but actually the 44% is a slight uptick from how he's been polling in our polls over the last over the last year or so. He started at about 38%, if I remember correctly, back in January. So he has been inching his way up, and a lot can happen between now and November. And especially, I think the economy will, you know, could have the very, you know, the most impact on this at the end of the day.
One thing that I will caution folks about is what I would call the Trump factor, though, in which he generally underpolls his actual performance, because there's a certain percentage of the population that do support him, but they don't trust pollsters or anyone. They don't necessarily want to tell anyone.
I think you touched on it right there. They're ashamed of their vote. They're for him, but they're ashamed of it. They won't tell anybody.
I don't know if they're ashamed of it or they just don't trust the pollsters or anyone else. And Tamar, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think y'all actually did a poll after the 2016 election in terms of who you voted for. And the poll showed like 5% less people admitted to who they voted for than who actually voted for them, as opposed to I think y'all were dead on in terms of Hillary Clinton. So you got to factor in that. And you know, and also, once again, and Tamar sort of gave that cautionary tale that we are a year out. And when it comes down to a binary choice in November 2020, you know, folks are going to vote on what do they believe is their best interest.
Yeah, that's why I did a disclaimer at the start of that. These are fantasy matchups. They have nothing to do with the reality of what the campaigns will shape up to be after the primaries are over with next year. One other point about Purdue, Edward. It was interesting that he issued a statement the other day, or said it on one of the channels he appears on. We've got to get past this gridlock in Washington. What a wonderful aspirational thing to say. How do you think the president is contributing to the effort to get past gridlock?
I think that there are so many guilty parties in Washington,
fair enough,
on both sides of the political aisle, that I don't think you can necessarily point to any one. The fact of the matter is, and this is the danger of Democrats as they go through this impeachment process, is that there are a large number of people out there who are going, wait a minute, we elected you XYZ Democratic congressman or senator to deal with issues that affect us at home, not this issue. And the longer this thing drags out, I think it could very well turn on Democrats.
All right. Finally, one last item from the poll that's worth pointing out, because later in the show we'll talk about yesterday's impeachment hearing. 54% of voters approve of the impeachment inquiry, while 44% disapprove. On the other hand, when it comes to removing the president from office, it's an even split, 47% to 47%, yes and no. But Tamar, again, this is an interesting figure, at least. When you get into the crosstabs on this poll, 51% of independents, the people that both parties are going to be looking to win over next year, 51% of independents say they're against removing Trump. Should we read anything into that, Tamar?
I mean, I guess they're the ones to be watching in all of this. And as we go through these hearings, you see both parties really searching for that breakthrough moment in all of the testimony. And so, you know, hoping to capture the mind of all those undecided independents.
Tamar's got the right point here. This thing's got to play out, Bill.
Yeah,
we've only had two witnesses in so far, and everybody is already trying to call the game. And we need to see what it's like. I've tried a lot of lawsuits, just like Edward has, and I don't think your verdict is going to be determined on your first witness. If your first witness helps, then you build on that and so forth. So I think there's a big rush to judgment on everybody's side. I know the media up there wants an immediate answer. They're looking for this point and that point. But we just got to show some patience and see where this thing goes and see what the testimony produces.
Right. Well, you're right. I mean, the fact of the matter is we live in a 24-hour news cycle, and they got to fill 24 hours worth of time. And so they've got to have the instant pundit as to whether or not what will be the ultimate verdict.
Was that Is this fake news we're talking about now, Edward?
No, no, not this station, not this show. You know, we are offering sage advice on this one. But you know, like I said a moment ago, you know, not only the Democrats, but Republicans, this is a landmine that they're both navigating its way through.
Yeah.
If the Democrats show themselves to be overly partisan, they are in danger of alienating the public. If the Republicans appear to be overly, I think your term was toady a moment ago. They appear to be less than what
all right.
the voters want.
I got to get to a break, but I also, as I do that, want to point out that Sam, Tom, and I were talking before the show about how we were going to put our show, what order we wanted to take items in. And both Sam and Tom cautioned me that the minute I mentioned the word impeachment, we could end up going down the rabbit hole yes. that we always go down. Thank you, Mr. Lindsay, for proving that they were.
Right. I'm guilty also. I'm guilty also.
We will talk about impeachment, but we got a couple items we're going to get to before that. But right now, let's get our first break out of the way, and we'll be back in a minute.
Not happy with the deal or trade-in quote for your old car? You could always donate it to this station. It's worth a lot to us, and pickup is free. Give us a call to learn more.
Call 877-GPB-1-CAR or go to gpb.org/cars. That's 877-GPB-1-CAR or gpb.org/cars. And thanks.
Support for GPB comes from our monthly sustainers. And the Atlanta Journal-Constitution is part of a statewide investigation into assisted living facilities. The AJC makes the crime and inspection reports they uncovered available in a searchable database accessed at ajc.com/unprotected. And Augusta University, in coordination with the Harry Jacobs Chamber Music Society, presenting the Warp Trio, a cross-genre chamber music experience, on November 15th at 7:30 p.m. Tickets available at augustauniversitytickets.com.
Tamar Hallerman is joining us from Washington. Buddy Darden and Edward Lindsay are here in the GPB radio studio in Midtown Atlanta. Buddy, there was an interesting report that this was released by Debbie Stabenow, the representative from Michigan, from the Midwest, a Farm Belt
senator,
a member of the House. Stabenow?
No, she's a member of the Senate.
Senator, I'm sorry.
From Michigan.
I'm sorry. Of course she is.
But she was a member of the House.
Yeah. Thank you. So she got a hold of some figures that we'll see more on this down the road. But USDA and Sonny Perdue, of course, have begun to parcel out money that's been earmarked for the China tariff relief for farmers in this country. And she is disappointed when she saw that Southern farmers, and Georgia in particular, are getting a disproportionate amount of the money compared to people in the Midwest. So, for instance, Georgia's farmers are getting $52 plus per acre. Farmers in 34 other states are receiving $25 or less, and some of them are only getting $10. And she points out that she thinks that Sonny Perdue, Georgia gets the biggest chunk of all this. So she's seeing political favoritism at work. And, you know, good for the farmers of South Georgia if they're getting help because they've got Sonny Perdue on their side up there. But, you know, I wonder if how Midwestern farmers are going to react to this.
Well, first of all, I think she's probably right. I say more power to Georgia farmers. I'm glad we're getting the money. I'm from Hancock County, which has got to be the poorest county in the state almost.
Hancock County is getting $150 per acre.
I was so pleased to see that because
we need
the money.
And next door, Baldwin County is getting $15. What the heck?
Well, I don't know what the formula is.
Yeah.
I will, of course, you can't take politics out of politics, and these are largely political decisions that the secretary is fortunately making in favor of our state, so I'm not going to criticize him for it.
No,
But 2 points that I think are important in terms of context here. Number one is that while the amount per acre may be higher in Georgia than it is in some other states, actually the bulk of the money is going to the Midwest. Iowa, Illinois, Minnesota, Texas, and Kansas, according to the report, are receiving a much higher amount of money than Georgia is, or the southern states are. Number two,
in aggregate.
Yeah, in aggregate. But and then
that
the second
help
point,
an individual farmer.
Yeah, but the second point that Sonny Perdue's agricultural department raised is that this money is based on the impact of the tariffs and not on geography. And that's what this study doesn't show, is drilling down whether or not a farmer raising peanuts in another state versus a farmer raising peanuts in Georgia or receiving a different amounts of money.
Tamar,
that's what the study doesn't show.
Tamar, do you have a take on this?
I mean, one thing I've learned covering agriculture, and I've gotten a real crash course ever since Sonny Perdue was nominated, is so much of the dynamic here is less political and more regional. And there was a lot of mistrust from the Midwesterners when Sonny Perdue's name first surfaced, because the last few secretaries of agriculture were all from the Midwest, including Tom Vilsack, the most recent one. I believe he was from Iowa or Nebraska. And so there was a deal that was cut with Chuck Grassley in the Senate. When Trump nominated Sonny Perdue, the idea was, okay, Sonny Perdue's deputy will be a Midwesterner. And ultimately, Sonny was confirmed pretty much, you know, because he was qualified, but also because there was a senior ranking Midwestern person. So you're constantly seeing that sort of regional dynamic play out on the Hill. And obviously, that's happening here.
Edward, the reason I mentioned that you could say that as a state at large may have gotten more money in the Midwest than down here is one of the things that the report asserts is that USDA hasn't done much to target assistance to the small, medium, and beginning farmers, which reminds us of Sonny Perdue, what some would call a gaffe, going before a group of farmers and saying the family farm, forget about it, corporate farms are taking over.
Well, yeah, and but like I said, to get back to my point that I raised a moment ago, these are interesting numbers. The question is whether or not a small farmer who has a particular crop is being treated the same as a large farmer, and for that, a large agribusiness, and for that matter, whether or not a farmer in this state and that in another and versus another state raising the same crop is receiving different amounts.
Okay.
That's something the study doesn't show us.
Okay. This has always been this way because of the regional different set of crops and so forth and so on. It's further complicated by the fact that now the president of the American Farm Bureau Federation, as you know, is from Georgia, Greene County as well.
Yeah.
So a lot of pressure on the Department of Agriculture now. And there's always going to be this tension between the Midwest and the South.
And the question is which farmers are being most impacted by these tariffs that have been levied in regards to our trade with China.
All right. Well, good news for our farmers down in you know, those of you who are listening in rural Georgia, congratulations. And more good news, last Friday, Sonny Perdue's office announced that Georgia, Florida, and Alabama are getting $800 million plus in relief, emergency relief after Hurricane Michael. Georgia is going to receive something like $347 million, almost half of that money. Perdue says, Tamar, the money's going to get to people by Thanksgiving, but a number of other USDA officials said, well, it's going to get to them. It may not be before Thanksgiving. But if it's true, thank goodness this relief is finally on the way.
Yeah, more than a year since the hurricane hit, so it's more than time. And this specific money was very much sought by Governor Kemp and Agriculture Commissioner Gary Black. This particular format that the aid money is coming, you know, they say gives them a lot of flexibility to target folks, especially pecan growers and timber farmers who fall outside the traditional kind of aid packages after hurricanes. So money that's very desperately needed in South Georgia.
You know, as Buddy likes to trumpet his rural roots, I'll trumpet mine. As the grandson of a farmer in Wilcox County with still roots down there, they need the money, and the quicker they get it, the better.
One other piece of good news for Georgia's ag interests, Chinese, that we apparently now have a deal. I haven't gotten a chance to read the details, but apparently the tariffs on chicken, the administration has reached a deal that is going to allow farmers here to sell chickens again to China. That just came up in the last couple of hours here. And boy, that's really good news for all those people who are chicken producers up there in the Gainesville area.
That's right. Georgia is a huge producer of in the poultry area. And the quicker we can get those disputes with China resolved and get our agricultural folks being able to sell the product, the better.
All right. Let's move on. One more item before we talk about impeachment. I just want to make sure, Tamar, I know you haven't thrown your hat in the ring, but Edward, buddy, you both have until 5 o'clock tomorrow afternoon. Governor Kemp has set a deadline for people. Is it Monday at 5 o'clock? You're probably right. Yeah, you're probably right. Okay, Monday at 5 o'clock. That's it. So he's going to basically have a big pool of candidates by then. Edward, buddy, either of you going to throw your head in the ring for this?
I'm not, but I'd like to throw Gary Black into the mix. I think he'd be an excellent senator, and it's going to be interesting to see if Chief Justice Harold Melton steps up at the very last minute.
Well, Buddy and I were discussing this earlier on, but when we heard that Tamar was coming back from Washington and we had a chance to continue to be on your show, Bill, we just decided to pass this
down. No, Tamar, this is going to be one of the most heralded announcements that we could expect to see in electoral politics in the final weeks of 2019. It's going to be really interesting. First of all, it's going to be interesting to hear whether Brian Kemp tries to step on the Democrats at all next week by announcing his choice before the Democratic debate.
Exactly. And I'm hoping for some bachelor-style rose ceremony or some sort of coronation. But we'll see. And we're also expecting a lot of big names to apply in the next couple of days. A lot of folks were kind of waiting for this final signal from Kemp. Maybe people who are currently in nonpartisan roles in corporate America or in the courts, or maybe they represent, they're an elected official for another office, who are kind of waiting. And now that they know that Kemp is about to close, I'm expecting to see a lot more big names. And we saw just today news that Robin Crittenden, the first African-American woman, tapped for a statewide post after Brian Kemp resigned Secretary of State. She served for a couple weeks there late last year. She put her name forward.
And let's see what Chris Carr, Attorney General Chris Carr, I don't think he has put his name in to this point, but he's certainly been talked about a whole lot, and we'll flush him out in the next few days. Mm-hmm. And, of course, Brian Kemp is not bound to that list, is he? If he changed his mind, he could appoint somebody not on the list.
Probably, but Edward, if you've gone to all this trouble to have this big public application and you pick somebody who didn't apply, there's a downside to that.
My guess is if the governor has someone that he likes, who hasn't applied yet, there's going to be a wink and a nod to say, hey, get your name in. But Tamar is right. There's going to be a lot of very interesting people applying the last few days. And someone like Robin Crittenden, who has a career in public service, is a very strong candidate.
All right, well, Harold Melton, the Chief Justice,
an African-American Chief Justice of the Georgia Supreme Court.
David Namias, the presiding judge, would be very much in favor of him because that would make him the Chief Justice.
Yeah. All right, so two quick notes before we get to a break. Number one is the fact that we are going to have Cody Hall as part of our panel tomorrow. He's Governor Kemp's press secretary, so we'll grill him as best we can to get whatever information we can pound out of him about if he's certainly not going to reveal the choice. He may not know. But maybe we can get him to give us some hints as to whether we're going to get that announcement soon. And then the other quick note before our break, our assistant news director, Josephine Bennett, made an interesting observation this morning. And Tamar, I don't know. I assume that this is correct. If Doug Collins is selected to replace Johnny Isaacson in January, Collins, as the ranking member of the Judiciary Committee, will get the chance to vote, presumably, on articles of impeachment. Then, of course, he'll get to vote when it's taken up, if the Judiciary Committee passes it, which it certainly is expected to. He'll get to vote on the floor for the measure. And if he's appointed senator, he becomes a member of the jury. There's no rule that he can't do both roles, right?
No, but he would be prohibited under Georgia law for doing that because a grand juror who votes to indict cannot serve on the Pettit jury by constitution in the state of Georgia. However, I don't think that would be the case up there in Washington. I think he'll get two votes.
All right.
Yeah. Not sure.
All right. Well, I'll tell you what. Tomorrow, that's something that would be fun to dig into a little bit more. But let's do this. Let's take a break. And then, yes, we'll talk about impeachment. This is Political Rewind.
On the next Fresh Air, Reese Witherspoon. She executive produced and stars with Jennifer Aniston in the new Apple TV Plus series, The Morning Show. It's about a network TV morning show in which the male anchor is fired after an accusation of sexual misconduct. Witherspoon has been outspoken about sexual harassment in the entertainment industry. Join us.
Fresh Air is this afternoon at 3 on GPB and online at gpbnews.org or ask your smart speaker to play GPB.
Support for GPB comes from generous listeners like you and Oglethorpe University Hammock School of Business, where curious, compassionate students acquire skills for their first job and their next job. The Hammock School of Business, working to create robot-proof leaders. Find out more at oglethorpe.edu. And Georgia DBHDD Office of Behavioral Health Prevention, reminding Georgians to ask their doctor about alternatives to opioid pain medication. Insurers can be consulted about covering non-opioid pain medication and therapies.
We're back on Political Rewind. Okay, so we had our first impeachment public hearing yesterday, and I want to get the panel to weigh in a little bit on what you all heard. But before I do that, you know, it was remarkable that we had these two veteran professional diplomats on the witness stand. And after all of the talk over the months about the deep state and the prejudices of the deep state against President Trump, we finally got to hear from two people who have really devoted their lives to public service. And I want to play a starting point here. We'll play a little sound. But I want to play just for a minute. Eric Swalwell, a Democrat on the committee, asked the following question and got the response that you'll hear.
Mr. Kent, are you a never Trumper?
I am a career non-professional who serves whatever president is duly elected and carries out the foreign policies of that president in the United States. And I've done that for 27 years for three Republican presidents and two Democrat presidents.
Ambassador Taylor, are you a never Trumper?
No, sir.
So, Tamar, Taylor and Kent asked that question. Trump has been calling them never Trumpers for quite a while now. What? Tell us, first of all, in general, what was it? Were you in the halls yesterday? What was the mood like up there?
You know, everyone was tuning in all day, but this was also a 6-hour long hearing, and it didn't feel, at least from my perspective, it didn't feel like it had the same kind of spellbinding. It wasn't the same spellbinding moment that it was when Brett Kavanaugh and Christine Blasey Ford were testifying. That's my take anyway. You know, folks were tuning in, and you watched it. You could see it on everyone's TV screens as you walk by people's offices and desks. But it didn't feel like it was the same because I think a lot of it has been playing out for so long. Behind closed doors, we got a lot of those tidbits. It didn't feel like it had quite the same impact.
Buddy?
I watched most of it. And doing other things. And I was very impressed with the witnesses. I thought that they came across to me as unbiased. I think we reward them for their public service. And I think the characterization that Ranking Member Nunes made was unfortunate. And I don't think it helps him to do that at all. But again, as I was saying a while ago, this is going to last for 2 or 3 weeks. Let's see what people say. Let's see what the evidence shows, and then we'll see where the vote goes. I was in Congress when we had several impeachments. Of course, none of us ever bothered to go to the committee or paying attention to it till it got to the floor.
Wait, so you were the Lindsey Graham of earlier impeachment efforts. That I mean Lindsey Graham said, no, I'm not going to be paying attention. I'm not going to read the transcript.
No, I read the committee reports in each instance, and I voted on to impeach I think, either three or four federal judges, one of whom ended up in the Congress before.
Who was that?
This was Alcy Hastings.
Impeached and convicted.
Yeah, that's right.
He was convicted by the Senate.
Yes, exactly.
Then elected to the Congress.
Yes.
And came up.
Florida?
And yeah. I went by to see him and said, hello, we're glad to have you here.
Apparently a bribe was not considered a necessarily bad thing for someone going to Congress. I think both of these gentlemen came across yesterday as committed public servants. I think that we should respect their years of service to our country. What I was most impressed with both of these folks is that they came across, for want of a better term, as Joe Fridays. Just the facts.
Yeah.
They did a very good job laying out what they knew. And they were very explicit about what they didn't know. And so when folks tried to push them to take opinions or to say something that was outside of the scope of their actual knowledge, they were very quick to stay within their lane. And I think that's very much to the credit of both of them. And quite frankly, allowed both sides to walk away with certain talking points regarding what they knew and the concerns that they raised about the policy shifts that they perceived as happening. They made points for the Democrats. And in terms of who they never actually talked to when it comes to President Trump, for instance, they gave talking points to the Republicans. And to both of their credits as career diplomats, that's kind of what I want someone like that to do. Just give us right. The facts and then let the Congress and the American people decide what's going on.
And then let other witnesses fill in the gaps if there are gaps to fill in or if they have the information. But again, you build a case not on what the first two witnesses say. It's a cumulative amount of the evidence as it comes forward. And if it's there, then the vote, and then the American people will really have a chance to make up their mind as well. But everybody seems to want to rush to judgment one way or another. And I think we just ought to let the process undo and see where it goes.
Well, Tamara, I want to go back to your comments at the beginning of this segment that you didn't feel the sense of excitement, focus, intense kind of concentration on this the way you did with Brett Kavanaugh and Christine Blasey Ford. Do you suspect then, how do you think that translates to whether people, I haven't seen ratings yet, I don't know if anybody here has, but what do we think about whether the public out there across the country was tuned into this tomorrow? I know in some ways it's speculation, but what do you guess about that?
I'm not sure, but based on a lot of the officials who were in the room and folks you know we were talking to after, it didn't seem like it changed anybody's mind.
Because keep
in mind that both of these guys testified behind closed doors before. So there were some new things that came out. I can't remember if it was Taylor or Kent yesterday who disclosed a new phone call between the ambassador to the EU, Sondland, and the president in a cafe in Kiev.
It was Bill Taylor's an aide to Bill Taylor who said, yes, he was in the room when Gordon Sondland was talking on a cell phone to the president and heard the president basically say, I want this investigation, period. And and Taylor further testified that after the aide hung up the phone, after Sondland hung up the phone, the aide said to Sondland, what is he saying about Ukraine? And Sondland said he's much more interested in the investigation. So just to say that a little bit more specifically, Tamar.
Yeah, it just felt like everybody's opinions that were already previously held were reinforced. And maybe these are just politicians being politicians and playing for their side. But, I haven't seen so far, it doesn't feel like there's been any sort of seismic shift in the public.
Yeah, okay. Let's play a little bit more, because I want to get your take, all of you, on we know how the Democrats proceeded. They were there to build a case for impeachment. You may or may not agree with the fact, you may not agree that they have a case, but it was clear that their effort was going to be to methodically build a case that the president did commit acts that deserve his being impeached. The Republicans seem to have a different agenda. Let me start by playing for you a little portion of Devin Nunes's opening statement.
What we will witness today is a televised theatrical performance staged by the Democrats. Ambassador Taylor and Mr. Kent, I'd like to welcome you here. I'd like to congratulate you for passing the Democrat Star Chamber auditions held for the last weeks in the basement of the Capitol. It seems you agreed, witting or unwittingly, to participate in a drama. But the main performance, the Russia hoax, has ended, and you've been cast in the low-rent Ukrainian sequel.
So that was Devin Nunes in his opening remarks. And then a little bit later, remember that Jim Jordan was added to the Intelligence Committee as a temporary member and put there very specifically to be a pit bull on the attack to try to undermine the Democrats' argument. I'm going to play a little bit longer exchange in which Jordan took some time to quiz Bill Taylor, and you'll hear the exchange as it unfolded.
Ambassador, you weren't on the call, were you? The president, you didn't listen on President Trump's call and President Zelensky's call?
I did not.
You've never talked with Chief of Staff Mulvaney?
I never did.
You never met the president?
That's correct.
You had three meetings again with Zelensky and it didn't come up.
And two of those they had never heard about, as far as I know.
And President
there was no reason for it.
President Zelensky never made an announcement. This is what I can't believe. And you're their star witness. You're their first witness.
You're the guy
based on this, based on, I mean, I've seen church prayer chains that are easier to understand than this. Ambassador Taylor recalls that Mr. Morrison told, now again, this is, I hereby swear and affirm from Gordon Sondland. Ambassador Taylor recalls that Mr. Morrison told Ambassador Taylor that I told Mr. Morrison that I conveyed this message to Mr. Yarmak on September 1st, 20. This all happens, by the way, in Warsaw, where Vice President Pence meets with President Zelensky. And guess what?
Taylor,
they didn't talk about any linkage either.
Time of the gentleman's expired. Ambassador Taylor, would you like to respond?
Let me just say that I don't consider myself a star witness for anything.
They do. You don't.
No, I don't. I'm responding to your question.
Please don't interrupt the witness.
As I think I was clear about, I'm not here to take one side or the other or to advocate any particular outcome. So let me just restate that.
All right. So, Edward, let's think about Georgia voters. Fine. Jim Jordan and Devin Nunes, no question, solidified their arguments with the Trump base here. But you can't win Georgia by just attracting the base. You've got to go after independent voters. You've got to have those suburban women who've been gone both directions on voting in the past. I will tell you, I just wonder, especially Jordan and the approach he'd had. By the way, it's cold in Washington. Can we get a fund together to buy him a darn coat? For God's sake? Edward,
interesting
is this
you
the
say
way
that.
You win over voters?
Well,
with
once
that
again, to sort of build on what Buddy's point is, you know, and I spent most of my career in litigation on the defense side, is that you build your defense one building block after another. And the fact is that I thought actually Jordan did a better job than Nunes did, because he stayed within a narrow lane. He didn't disparage these two individuals' characters. And he simply pointed out that neither of these witnesses had firsthand knowledge of what President.
Okay,
so for that reason, that's fine. The question is, gets back to Buddy's point, what do we hear on Friday? What do we hear for the 3 days next week and beyond that? And that's a question that we don't know yet, because the defense is still being formed.
If Edward Lindsay were defending that case, though, he would not make an opening statement calculated to alienate some of the jurors.
I'm just suggesting.
Well, that's my point. That's why I thought Jordan did a better job than
the,
Nunes
is
did.
Is the tone, Tamar? Is the tone that Jordan takes that aggressive, talk a mile a minute, patter, going to be appealing to people out there who really are on the fence about President Trump?
I don't know, but I think, you know, kind of going back to what I said earlier, you know, everybody is kind of throwing everything they can at the wall to see what sticks. You know, Democrats are bringing up every credible witness they have to try and have that viral moment. And so are the Republicans in their caucus. Okay. You have Nunes kind of taking one approach. You have Jim Jordan taking the other. And everyone's hoping to have that quote that makes it into the evening news, that makes it onto Political Rewind.
All right. Yeah, you're right. All right. I'm running out of time, but I want to play two sound bites that absolutely reinforce what Tamara is saying. Here is how Fox and Friends talked about the impeachment hearing yesterday. This is from their show this morning.
So Steve Scalise, congressman from Louisiana, Republican, House Minority Whip, he said it was a really bad day for Adam Schiff and for the Democrats. Listen.
This was a real bad day for Adam Schiff and this whole charade, this witch hunt that they've been promoting for months now. When John Ratcliffe actually asked the two star witnesses, these were the first witnesses that the Democrats brought out to make their case. He said, can either of you name an impeachable offense? And dead silence. Jim Jordan showed these secondhand, thirdhand, fourthhand, these career bureaucrats who I'm sure they've studied Ukraine policy for decades. But the bottom line is there's only one person that sets foreign policy for the United States of America, and that's our commander in chief, Donald Trump.
And this is how Joe Scarborough and Morning Joe talked about it.
Well, anybody that was expecting a repeat of the testimony of Robert Mueller would have been surprised by what happened yesterday. We had some new revelations, some pretty shocking revelations, and also, though mainly a lot of steady testimony that continues to blow holes in the Republicans and the White House's defense. So we'll get to that in a little bit. It is something, though, how Republicans are chasing their tails and coming up with laughable defenses that will once again be proven false in the coming days.
All right, we're running out of time. Tamar, I offer you those two sound bites to enter into evidence to prove your case that everybody's already locked down and maybe they're not listening to anything. Edward, did you want to get into that?
What I will do is to borrow from my liberal arts education and The Tale of Two Cities, Charles Dickens. It was the best of times. It was the worst of times. It was a season of light. It was a season of darkness. It was the spring of hope. It was the winter of despair.
Oh, my God. Gosh. All right,
and I want to point out very briefly to Tamar, with all due respect, is that the press thinks it's the obligation of the Congress and the committee to entertain them, and that's not quite correct. The point is that they're supposed to bring out the facts, and I think they're off to a good start.
Wait a minute. Tamar, I think Buddy Darden just took a shot at our profession that I wish, I'm serious, I wish we had more time to argue. Anyhow, I think the point that you made is proven by those two conflicting morning show sound bites, don't you?
I mean, we love our sound bites. It's true.
All right. And that's the last word for this show. We love our sound bites, which kind of proves Buddy's case, but let's not go too far with that right now. Tamar Hallerman, looking forward to seeing you here in Atlanta very soon. Edward Lindsay, Buddy Darden, thank you so much for being with us on Political Rewind today. We're back tomorrow for another show. As I said, one of our panelists, Cody Hall, the governor's press secretary. It's going to be interesting to hear what he has to say, especially about where we're headed with a selection to replace Johnny Isaacson. I'm Bill Nigut. See you again tomorrow at 2:00.